Here's golf legend John Daly.
Hell yeah, these wins are piling up faster than my divorces.
I only spent on Moto, America's social casino. You know I've won a couple of majors. And on Moto, I've won majors, grands, and epic jackpots on their classic Vegas slots with huge, huge bonus rounds. Moto Casino adds new games and awards players free coins every single day. Grip it and spin it on Moto Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
At my bank, I was literally getting pennies using Wealthfront. Cha-ching!
Meet Angela, a Wealthfront cash account client since 2023.
I left my job, not having something else lined up yet. I was pregnant with my second. We had to think about how do we make our money work for us. Every month, there's this much that I'm getting in interest, and I didn't have to do anything. My money is working hard on its own, and I can trust Wealthfront is taking care of me.
With a Wealthfront cash account, earn up to 4.2% APY on your cash. No account fees, no minimums, and no strings attached. Plus, free instant withdrawals to eligible accounts. Get started at Wealthfront.com. Client was paid $1,000 for their testimonial, creating a conflict of interest. Outcomes vary. 3.3% base APY as of January 30th, 2026 is representative, variable, and earned on funds swept to program banks. 0.65% new client boost for 3 months on up to $150,000. Direct deposit $1,000 a month and fund an investing account for a 0.25% increase. Cash account offered by Wealthfront Brokerage, LLC, member FINRA, SIPC, not a bank. Instant withdrawal subject to conditions. Fees and eligibility requirements may apply to certain checking features of the cash account.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends. With thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Christmas time, 1988. Air travel is bustling as families worldwide take to the skies to quickly and efficiently return home for the holidays. On the ground, families would be preparing for their upcoming guests, making homes festive and warm for the upcoming holiday. All of that would be ruined as 270 lives would be taken in the air as a result of the bombing of Pan Am Flight 103.
Sometimes the human mind goes to dark places. Sometimes those dark delusions turn into a reality. A reality so shaded and gray, once all is said and done, the healthy mind is drawn into the documented retelling of these tragic events, trying to find logic, reason, and understanding where there may be none at all. This is the dark side of Wikipedia.
Pan Am Flight 103 was a regularly scheduled Pan Am transatlantic flight from Frankfurt to Detroit via London and New York City on the 1st of December 1988. The aircraft operating the transatlantic leg of the route was destroyed by a bomb, killing all 243 passengers and 16 crew in what became known as the Lockerbie bombing. Large sections of the aircraft crashed into a residential street in Lockerbie, Scotland, killing 11 people on the ground, with a total of 270 people killed. It is the deadliest terrorist attack in the history of the United Kingdom. Following a 3-year joint investigation by Dumfries and Galloway and the U.S. Federal Bureau of Investigation, arrest warrants were issued for two Libyan nationals in November of 1991. In 1999, leader Muammar Gaddafi handed over the two men for trial at Camp Zeist, Netherlands. After protracted negotiations and U.N. sanctions in 2001, Abdelbest El-Magari, a Libyan intelligence officer, was jailed for life after being found guilty of 270 counts of murder in connection with the bombing. In August of 2009, he was released by the Scottish government on compassionate grounds after being diagnosed with prostate cancer. He died in May of 2012 as the only person to be convicted for the attack. In 2003, Gaddafi accepted responsibility for the Lockerbie bombing and paid compensation to the families of the victims, although he maintained that he had never given an order for the attack. Acceptance of responsibility was part of a series of requirements laid out by a UN resolution in order for sanctions against Libya to be lifted. Libya said it had to accept responsibility due to Magari's status as a government employee. During the Libyan civil war of in 2011, former Minister of Justice Mustafa Abdul Jalil claimed that the Libyan leader had personally ordered the bombing, but this was later denied. While investigators have long believed that Magari did not act alone and have been reported as questioning retired Stasi agents about a possible role in the attack, some relatives of the dead, including the Lockerbie captain Dr. Jim Swire, believe the bomb was planted at Heathrow Airport and not sent via feeder flights from Malta, as the U.S. and U.K. claim. The cell belonging to the Popular Front for the Liberation of the Palestine General Command had been operating in West Germany in the months before the Pan Am bombing. So this was always a very well-known aircraft disaster that I remember hearing about a lot as a child. Quite a dark story surrounding it. We're going to dive into it re-educate ourselves in what happened with it today on the dark side of Wikipedia. Tony and Jenny Brewski joining you once again. Press subscribe wherever you download podcasts so you don't miss any of our episodes.
I don't remember much until being older and learning about this in school, obviously, because we were very young when this happened.
Yeah.
But was this the first of its kind as far as something like this happening? I mean, I know there'd been other hijacks and things like that, but this seemed to be the one that just kind of caught everybody and really, I don't know, it just the horror of it, because it seemed like it's not something anybody had thought of before.
Outside of war, I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know the answer to that, if it was one of the first or the first commercial, you know, where they just literally killed civilians. I don't know the answer to that off the top of my head. Obviously it still stands to this day as one of the deadliest terrorist attack in that area, of it going down, of where it crashed. But I don't know if this was the first of its kind of a plane blowing up from a terrorist bombing. But here's what I already have issue with in the first part of the what we talked about. So the guy kills, or part of the conspiracy to kill, you know, all these people, 270 people on an airplane. But he's getting old and he has cancer, so we're going to be compassionate and let him out. Fuck that. Why? I have compassion for a lot of things. Killing 270 people and now you get cancer, I don't fucking care. That's my answer to that one.
Yeah.
I mean, at that point, I don't fucking care. There's no you pissed all over your compassion card when you were part of blowing up a fucking airplane.
Well, I think he can have cancer in prison as easily as outside of prison. You know,
my opinion would honestly be, oh, you got cancer, you're gonna die soon. Well, let's just stop feeding you.
Oh, well,
if you're the airplane bomber, I'm not saying that to anyone. I'm saying if you blew up a fucking airplane with 270 people on it, why? What are we keeping you around for?
Yeah, I don't know that they have capital punishment over there.
Okay, well, that might be part of it.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's funny because they were like in that part of the world in like medieval ages, they had some crazy shit that they could do.
Well, you're right. They did. But I think they've gone through a change or two.
Adjusted?
Yeah. There's been several years since been the case.
The Crusades have subsided a little bit.
Medieval times, right. So I think that, you know, maybe that was part of it, is that keeping him in prison would guarantee his death.
Yeah.
So maybe that's why they felt compelled to let him out. I don't know.
I just don't get that I get it when it's lesser crimes and things of that nature, the compassion thing. So I'm not saying it across the board, but this one is just like, I'm sorry, you checked too many fucking boxes on this.
Yeah.
You're not. The compassion card doesn't get a play here. You get, you know, maybe an extra cup of water. I don't see it being right.
I understand what you're saying, but you also can't just stop feeding them.
No, you're right. You probably can't.
I mean, if you're going to do, you know, capital punishment.
Then do it.
You have to make it quick and...
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah.
I agree. I guess if I was a family member of a victim of the flight, I'd be really even more pissed off than having no relation to anyone on the flight. This is just me just reading the story. I'm pissed off.
I get that. That's coming through loud and clear.
Yeah. Let's continue on with the story of Pan Am Flight 103. The aircraft operating Pan Am Flight 103 was a Boeing 747-121 and named Chipper Maid of the Seas. Prior to 1979, it had been named Clipper Morning Light. It was the 15th 747 built and was delivered in February of 1970, 1 month after the first 747 entered service with Pan Am. In 1978, as Clipper Morning Light, it had appeared in Conquering the Atlantic, the fourth episode of the BBC television documentary series Diamonds in the Sky, presented by Julian Pettifer. Pan Am Flight 103 originated as a feeder flight at Frankfurt Airport, West Germany, using a Boeing 727. Both Pan Am and TWA routinely changed the type of aircraft operating different legs of a flight. PA-103 was bookable as either a single Frankfurt-New York or Frankfurt-Detroit itinerary. The rescheduled change of aircraft took place in London's Heathrow Airport. Upon arrival at Heathrow Terminal 3 on the day of the disaster, passengers and their luggage, as well as an unaccompanied interline luggage on the feeder flight, transferred directly onto Clipper Maid of the Seas. His previous flight had originated from Los Angeles and arrived via San Francisco. The aircraft, which operated the flight's transatlantic leg, pushed back from the terminal at 18.04 hours and took off from runway 27R at 18.25. En route from New York... en route for New York JFK Airport and on to Detroit Metropolitan Wayne County Airport. Contrary to many popular accounts of the disaster, though repeated with reference below, the flight, which had a scheduled gate departure of 1,800 hours, left Heathrow Airport on time. After the bombing, the flight number was changed in accordance with standard practice among airlines after disasters. Within days, the Frankfurt-London-New York-Detroit route was being served by Pan Am Flight 3. Explosion and collision of the aircraft. At 1858, the aircraft established two-way radio contact with Sandwich Oceanic Air Control in Prestwick. The Clipper Maid of the Seas approached the corner of the Solway Firth at 19.01 hours and crossed the coast at 19.02 UTC. On scope, the aircraft showed transponder code, or squawk, 0357 in flight level 310. At this point, the Clipper Maid of the Seas was flying at 31,000 feet and heading of 316 degrees magnetic and a speed of 313 knots, calibrated airspeed. Subsequent analysis of the radar returned by RSRE concluded that the aircraft was tracking 321 degrees grid and traveling at a ground speed of 803 kilometers an hour. At 19.02.44, Alan Topp, the clearance delivery officer at Shanwick, transmitted its oceanic route clearance. The aircraft did not acknowledge this message. The Clipper Maid of the Seas squawk then flickered off. Air traffic control tried to make contact with the flight with no response. At this time, a loud sound was recorded on the cockpit voice recorder. At 19.02.50, five radar echoes fanning out appeared instead of one. Comparison of the cockpit voice recorder to the radar return showed that 8 seconds after the explosion, the wreckage had a one nautical mile spread. A British Airways pilot flying the London-Glasgow shuttle near Carlisle called Scottish authorities to report that he could see a huge fire on the ground. The explosion punched a 50-centimeter hole on the left side of the fuselage. Investigators from the U.S. Federal Aviation Administration concluded that no emergency procedures had been started in the cockpit. The cockpit voice recorder located in the tail section of the aircraft was found in the field by police searchers within 24 hours. There was no evidence of a distress signal. A 180 millisecond hissing noise could be heard as the explosion destroyed the aircraft's communication center. Although the explosion was in the aircraft hold, the effect was magnified by the large difference in pressure between the aircraft's interior and exterior uncontrolled decompression of the fuselage. The aircraft's elevator and rudder control cables had been disrupted, and the fuselage pitched downwards and to the left. Investigators from the Air Accidents Investigation Branch, AAIB, of the British Department of Transportation concluded that the noise of the aircraft was effectively blown off and was separated from the main section within three sections of the explosion. The nose cone was briefly held on by a band of metal but facing aft like the lid of a can, and then it sheared off, up and backwards, to starboard, striking off number three engine and landing some distance outside the town on a hill in Tunthergarth. The fuselage continued moving forward and down until it reached 19,000 feet, at which point its dive became nearly vertical. The rear fuselage parts of the baggage hold and three landing gear units landed at Rosebank Crescent. The fuselage consisting of the main wing box structure landed in Sherwood Crescent, creating a large impact crater where three homes previously stood. The 200,000-pound jet fuel ignited by the impact started fires, which destroyed several additional houses. Investigators were able to determine that both wings had landed in the Sherwood Crescent crater, saying the total absence of debris from the wing primary structure found remote from the crater confirmed the initial impression that the complete wing box structure had been present at the main impact. The British Geological Survey said 23 kilometers away at another area registered a seismic event at 19:03 hours, measuring 1.6 on the moment magnitude scale, which was attributed to the impact. According to the report, the rest of the wreckage composed of the complete fuselage forward of approximately station 480 to station 380, incorporating the flight deck and nose landing gear, was found as one piece in a field approximately 4 kilometers east of Lockerbie. This field, located opposite Tundergarth Church, is where the wreckage most easily identified with images of the accident in the media fell, having fallen almost flat on its left side, but with a slight nose-down altitude. All 243 passengers and 16 crew members were killed, as were 11 residents of Lockerbie on the ground. Of the 270 total fatalities, and 190 were American citizens, 43 British citizens, 19 other nationalities were represented, with 4 fewer passengers per country. Flight 103 was under the command of Captain James B. McQuare, an experienced pilot with almost 11,000 flight hours, of which more than 4,000 had been incurred in 747 aircraft. First Officer Raymond R. Wagner had approximately 5,500 flight hours in the 747 and a total of almost 12,000 flight hours. Flight Engineer Jerry D. Arvitt, who joined Pan Am in 1980 during a merger with National Airlines, had more than 8,000 hours of flying experience, with nearly 500 hours in the 747. The cockpit crew was based at JFK. 6 of the 13 cabin crew members became naturalized U.S. citizens while working for Pan Am. The cabin crew was based at Heathrow and lived in London and the London area, or communicated from around Europe. All were originally hired by Pan Am and ranged from 28 years to 9 months in seniority. The captain, first officer, flight engineer, a flight attendant, and several first-class passengers were found still strapped to their seats inside the nose section when it crashed in Tundergarth. The inquest heard that a flight attendant was found alive by a farmer's wife, but died before her discoverer could summon help. Some passengers may have remained alive briefly after impact. A pathologist report concluded that at least 2 of these 3 passengers might have survived if they had been found soon enough. Even Lockerbie residents on Sherwood Crescent were killed when the wing section hit their house at 13 Sherwood Crescent at more than 800 kilometers an hour and exploded, creating a crater 47 meters long with a volume of 560 cubic yards. The property was completely destroyed and its occupants were killed. Their bodies were never found. Several other houses and their foundations were destroyed, and 21 others were damaged so badly they had to be demolished. A family of 4 were killed when their house at 15 Sherwood Crescent exploded. A couple and their daughter were killed by the explosion in their house at 16 Sherwood Crescent. Their son witnessed a fireball engulfing his home from a neighbor's garage where he had been repairing his sister's bicycle. The other Lockerbie residents who died were 2 widows, aged 82 and 81, who had both lived in Sherwood Crescent. They were the 2 oldest victims of the disaster. The bodies of both 15 Sherwood Crescent children and both 16 Sherwood Crescent parents were never recovered. Father Patrick Keegans, Lockerbie's Roman Catholic priest, was preparing to visit the Henrys at approximately 7 p.m. that evening, with his mother having recently been appointed a parish priest of the town. Father Keegan's house at 1 Sherwood Crescent was the only one of the street that was neither destroyed by the impact nor gutted by fire. According to a BBC article on the fire published in 2018, Father Keegan's had gone upstairs to make sure that he had hidden his mother's Christmas present and recalls that immediately after that there was an enormous explosion. The same source claims that following this, the shaking stopped and to his surprise, he was uninjured. Mrs. Keegan's was also unharmed, having been shielded from debris by a freezer fridge. Despite being advised by the government not to travel to Lockerbie, many of the passengers' relatives, most of them from the U.S., arrived there within days to identify the dead. Volunteers from Lockerbie set up in staff's canteens, which stayed open 24 hours a day and offered relatives, soldiers, police officers, and social workers free sandwiches, hot meals, coffee, and someone to talk to. The people of the town washed, dried, and ironed every piece of clothing that was found once the police had determined they were of no forensic value, so that as many items as possible could be returned to the relatives. The BBC Scotland component, Andrew Cassell, reported on the 10th anniversary of the bombing that the townspeople had opened their homes and hearts to the relatives, bearing their own losses stoically and with enormous dignity, and that the bonds forged then continue to this day. So in a lot of ways, it's a story of where tragedy brought people together who otherwise would have never met each other. And just a story of how quickly it all happened. They had little to no knowledge of any comfort of what was going on at the moment, other than it sounds like, you know, they realized they were going down, obviously.
Yeah.
And then to have survived that. You know, that I think that would be the most terrifying. I think if the plane's going down, I'd rather be in the spot where the bomb goes off. Just then I'm done. Then I'm not like sitting there taking the ride.
Yeah, I agree. I'd rather go quick than to know what's going on.
Yeah. I mean, if I can survive, cool. I don't want to be blown to bits. But in most cases, people don't survive these things.
No.
Yeah, I would rather be just, okay, I'm out. I think of all the fears of ways of dying, aircraft is my number one.
Really?
Yeah, I don't like that one more than anything. Even before I saw, you know, horror movies, you know, that depict it, the worst to me was the original Final Destination. The crash scene there was just the fucking worst. If you don't like airplane crashes, don't watch that movie.
Right.
And that to me was just like, oh God, that's what it would probably be like. Mm-hmm. Except they didn't account for you'd probably be knocked out because of the oxygen and all that. Mm-hmm. I don't like flying. I really don't. And not that we have to fly that often, but I fucking hate flying.
Yeah. Yeah. I have no desire to get my, real ID so that I can fly. That's why I'd rather just drive.
Yeah.
And I know the statistics and everything, but it's the fear.
Yeah, it's irrational. I can say that. I know that. I know it's completely irrational statistically, but to me, it's like it's just, I don't know. It's just one of the worst ones. So that's that. There apparently was some information alerts that were given prior to this happening, and that's where we're going to pick it up as we continue talking about the flight of Pan Am 103. You're on the dark side of Wikipedia. Two alerts were released shortly before the bombing. The Helsinki warning on the 5th of December 1988, 16 days prior to the attack. The FAA issued a security bulletin saying that on that day, a man with an Arabic accent had telephoned the U.S. Embassy in Helsinki, Finland, and told them that a Pan Am flight from Frankfurt to the United States would be blown up within the next 2 weeks by someone associated with the Abu Nidal organization. He said a Finnish woman would carry the bomb on board as an unwitting courier. The anonymous warning was taken seriously by the U.S. government, and the State Department cabled the bulletin to dozens of embassies. The FAA sent it to all U.S. carriers, including Pan Am, which had charged each of the passengers a $5 security surcharge, promising a program that will screen passengers, employees, airport facilities, baggage, and aircraft with unrelenting thoroughness. The security team in Frankfurt found the warning under a pile of papers on a desk the day after the bombing. One of the Frankfurt security screeners, whose job was to spot explosive devices under X-ray, told ABC News that she had first learned what Semtex, a plastic explosive, was during her ABC interview 11 months after the bombing. On the 13th of December, the warning was posted on bulletin boards in the U.S. Embassy in Moscow and eventually distributed to the entire American community there, including journalists and businessmen. There's a PLO warning. Just days before the sabotage of the aircraft, security forces in European countries, including the UK, were put on alert after a warning from the Palestinian Liberation Organization, or PLO, that extremists might launch terrorist attacks to undermine the then ongoing dialogue between the United States and the PLO. The day of the bombing, the French Directorate General for the External Security was informed by their British counterpart that the English suspected the Libyans to be behind the bombing. According to the CIA analyst data, on the 22nd of December 1988, several groups were quick to claim responsibility in telephone calls in the United States and Europe. A male caller claimed that a group called the Guardians of the Islamic Revolution had destroyed the plane in retaliation for Iran Air Flight 655 being shot down by U.S. forces in the Persian Gulf the previous July. A caller claiming to represent the Islamic Jihad organization told ABC News in New York that the group had planned to plant the bomb to commemorate Christmas. Another caller claimed responsibility for the Ulster Defense League. Another caller claimed the plane had been downed by Mossad, the Israeli intelligence service. Its listed author noted, "We consider the claims from the Guardians of the Islamic Revolution as the most credible one received so far. But the analysis concluded we cannot assign responsibility for this tragedy to any terrorist group at this time. We anticipate that as often as it happens, many groups will seek to claim credit. Muammar Gaddafi took responsibility for the Lockerbie bombing and paid compensation to the victims' families in 2003, though he maintained that he had not ordered the attack. On the 22nd of February 2011, during the Libyan civil war, former Minister Justice Mustafa Abdul Jalil stated in an interview with the Swedish newspaper Expressen that Muammar Gaddafi had personally ordered the bombing. Jalil claimed to possess documents that prove his allegations and that he is ready to hand them over to the international criminal courts. In December of 2013, it was revealed that the original prime suspects in the bombing had been the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, General Command, a Syria-based group led by Ahmed Jibril. A flood of warnings immediately preceded the disaster, included one that read, "Team of Palestinians not associated with PLO intend to attack U.S. targets in Europe. Time frame is present. Targets specified are Pan Am Airlines and U.S. military bases." 5 weeks before this warning, Jibril's right-hand man, Hafez Delkonomi, had been arrested in Frankfurt with a known bomb maker, Marwin Karasat. Later, U.S. intelligence officials confirmed that members of the group had been monitoring Pan Am's facilities at Frankfurt Airport. On Delkamani's account, bombs made by Karastat were at large somewhere. A deep-cover CIA agent was told by up to 15 high-level Syrian officials that the PFLP-GC was involved and that officials interacted with Jibril on a constant basis. And in 2014, an Iranian ex-spy asserted that Iran ordered the attack. The Iranian Foreign Ministry swiftly denied any involvement.
You know, I'm not surprised that nobody wants to claim responsibility. I mean, that seems like the thing now is that terrorist attacks, people jump to claim responsibility, but on this one, it's like trying to figure out who was responsible was very difficult.
Yeah, and to add all the pieces up, it's funny because I can put myself back into December of 1988. Mm-hmm. I remember in December 1988. I don't remember the details of this very much. I remember playing with Legos and watching Peter Jennings report on it on World News Tonight. I was in kindergarten. Mm-hmm. You were in kindergarten. Mm-hmm. I remember 88 well, just because I remember the date on the wall. Always yeah. looking over at it. And I remember when it was 88.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember Christmas that year. I remember some of what I got that year. And it's just interesting to think of this as what was going on in the world at that moment in time.
Yeah.
And being a little kid and just kind of placing it. But this was the big, you know, how big of a thing this this was at that time. It's crazy just how many people are involved and how many warnings were given and how it ends up. We find the warning that Pan Am found a way to charge you for, but we're going to find a way to add an extra $5 to everybody's ticket. They're going to find a way to profit from it. But in terms of actually executing this, we're going to really check everybody down. That was put on the side burner. So like, it doesn't make a lot of sense to me. One part of the organization saw this and went, oh, we'll charge everybody an extra $5 because we can. And then the other part's like, we're not going to do shit. Put that on that pile over there.
Yeah.
That to me is pretty shitty.
Well, and that's part of the reason they're probably not in business anymore.
Yeah. Some of the warnings were very reminiscent of Bin Laden determined to strike U.S.
Mm-hmm.
Those same sort of warnings that we got right before 9/11 that were also kind of put to the side.
Yeah.
History repeats itself so often. And just when you think, oh, that ain't going to repeat itself. That was bad enough. We learned from that shit show. Guess what? And we saw it here. We see it with, you know, we saw it with 9/11 where we have all these warnings and, oh, it, you know, brush to the side. There was a documentary I just watched on Netflix. It was about Challenger.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very interesting because it really exposed NASA, exposed all of the deficiencies that were going on within NASA in terms of safety at the time and taking a look at all the warnings, many people within NASA saying, don't do this. Don't do it in this condition. Don't do it. But they were so obsessed with the PR because people were getting bored with space flight that they really wanted to get that flight into the air. And it was a rush decision to take that thing off that day. It was stupid. And they did it. And it was like, okay, we're going to investigate. Many people were fired. Many people, you know, lived the rest of their life. We're still alive today with tremendous guilt. And then in, was it 2004, 2005, when the other shuttle broke up mid-flight,
Columbia
in landing. There again, there was a lot of warnings. Mm-hmm. Same company or branch of government, whatever you want to call it. Had tons and tons of warnings. This could happen in flight. We need to watch out for this. This is not safe to be flying in its current state. You need to figure this out. And brushed off and brushed off and brushed off. And then something finally happened.
Yeah.
And Challenger really had been about 14 years earlier, mm-hmm. somewhere around then. I mean, in our lifetime, it was almost our whole lifetime. But in terms of like retrospect, looking back on it, you know, all these years later, it really wasn't that far back where it's like you clearly, you know, there's, you know, people change power, people change positions and such. And, you know, the memories of we really need to be, we can't let the ball drop.
Yeah.
We can't let the ball drop because of this. Those people leave positions and new people come in. Balls start getting dropped. Mm-hmm. And that's where even if you didn't have the experience itself, learning from others' experiences is so damn important because that's how it repeats itself.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how the cycle goes on. Let's continue on into the story of Pan Am Flight 103 and the investigation portion of the crash. Pan Am Flight 103 bombing investigation. The initial investigation into the crash site by Dumfries and Galloway involved many helicopter surveys, satellite imaging, and a search of the area by police and soldiers. The wreckage of the crash was scattered over 2,000 square kilometers, and AAIB investigators were confronted by a massive jigsaw puzzle in trying to piece the plane back together. In total, 8 million pieces of wreckage were collected and registered on computer files. More than 10,000 pieces of debris were retrieved, tagged, and entered into a computer tracking system. The perpetrators had apparently intended the plane to crash into the sea, destroying any traceable evidence, but the late departure time, contrary to statement with reference above, of the aircraft meant that its explosion over land left a trail of evidence. The fuselage of the aircraft was reconstructed by air accident investigators, revealing a 20-inch hole consistent with an explosion in the forward cargo hold. Examination of the baggage containers revealed that the container nearest the hole had a blackening pitting and severe damage, indicating a high-energy event had taken place inside it. A series of test explosions were carried out to confirm the precise location and quantity of explosives used. Fragments of a Samsonite suitcase believed to have contained the bomb were recovered, together with parts and pieces of circuit board identified as components of a Toshiba Bombeat, an RT-SF-16 radio cassette player, similar to that used to conceal a Semtex bomb seized by West German police from the Palestinian militant group Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine General Command 2 months earlier. Items of baby clothing, which were subsequently proven to have been made in Malta, were thought to have come from the same suitcase. The clothes were traced to Maltese merchant Tony Gauci, who became a key prosecution witness, testifying that he sold the clothes to a man of Libyan appearance. Gauci was interviewed 23 times, giving contradictory evidence about who had bought the clothes and the person's age and appearance and the date of purchase, but later identified Abdel Beltist al-Magari. As Magari had only been in Malta on the 7th of December, that date was assumed to be the purchase date. This date is in doubt, as Gauci had testified that Maltese Christmas lights had not been on when the clothes had been purchased. It was subsequently determined that the lights had been switched on the 6th of December. Scottish police had also failed to inform the defense that another witness had testified seeing Libyan men making similar purchases on a different day. An official report providing information not made available to the defense during the original trial stated that on April 19, 1999, 4 days before identifying al-Magari for the first time, Gauci had seen a picture of al-Magari in a magazine which connected him to the bombing, a fact which could have distorted his judgment. Gauci was shown the same magazine during his testimony at al-Magari's trial and asked if he had identified the photograph in April of 1999 as being the person who purchased the clothing. He was then asked if that person was in the court. Gauci then identified al-Magari for the court, stating, "He is a man on the side. He resembles him a lot." A circuit board fragment allegedly found embedded in a piece of charred material was identified as part of an electric timer similar to one found on Libyan intelligence agents who had been arrested 10 months previously for carrying materials for a Semtex bomb. The timer was allegedly traced through its Swiss manufacturer, Mebo, to the Libyan military, and Mebo employee Ulrich Lumpart identified the fragment at al-Magari's trial. Mebo's owner Edwin Ballier, testified at the trial that the Scottish police had originally shown him a fragment of a brown 8-ply circuit board from a prototype timer which had never been supplied to Libya. Yet the sample was asked to identify at the trial was given a 9-ply circuit board that Mebo had indeed supplied to Libya. Ballier wanted to pursue this discrepancy but was told by trial judge Lord Sutherland that he could not do so. Ballier claimed that in 1991, he had declined an offer for $4 million from the FBI in exchange for his support of the main line of inquiry, though that claim has never been verified. Known as the Lockerbie bombing and the Lockerbie air disaster in the UK, it was described by Scotland Lord Advocate as the UK's largest criminal inquiry led by the smallest police force in Britain, Dumfries and Galloway. After a 3-year joint investigation by Dumfries and Galloway and the U.S. Federal Bureau of Investigation, during which 15,000 witness statements were taken, indictments for murder were issued on the 13th of November 1991 against al-Magari, a Libyan intelligence officer and the head of security for Libyan Arab Airlines, and Liman Khalifa, FEMA, the LAA station manager in Luqa Airport, Malta, UN sanctions against Libya, and protracted negotiations with Libyan leader Colonel Muammar Gaddafi secured the handover of the accused on the 5th of April 1999 to Scottish police at Camp Zeist, Netherlands, which was selected as the neutral venue for their trial. Both the accused chose not to give evidence on court. On the 31st of January 2001, Magari was convicted of murder by a panel of three Scottish judges and sentenced to life imprisonment. But FEMA was acquitted. Magari's appeal against his conviction was refused on the 14th of March 2002, and his application to the European Court of Human Rights was declared inadmissible in July of 2003. On September 23, 2003, Magari applied to the Scottish Criminal Case Review Commission for his conviction to be reviewed on the 28th of June 2007. The SCCRC announced its decision to refer the case to the High Court of Judiciary in Edinburgh after it found he may have suffered a miscarriage of justice. Magari served just over 10 years of his sentence beginning the 5th of April 1999, first in Verilane Prison in Glasgow, and later in Greenock Prison, throughout which he maintained that he was innocent of charges against him. He was released from prison on compassionate grounds on the 20th of August 2009. In October of 2015, Scottish prosecutors announced that they wanted to interview two Libyan nationals whom they had identified as new suspects over the bombings. Trial, appeals, and the release, and the main article says a Pan Am Flight 103 bombing trial, which was on the 3rd of May 2000, the trial of Al-Balist El-Magari and Lamin Khalifa began. Magari was found guilty of 270 counts of murder on the 31st of January 2001 and was sentenced to life imprisonment in Scotland. His co-defendant was found not guilty. The Lockerbie judgment stated, "From the evidence which we have discussed so far, we are satisfied that it has been proven that the primary suitcase containing the explosive device was dispatched from Malta, passed through Frankfurt, and was loaded onto PA-103 at Heathrow. It is, as we have said, clear that with one exception, the clothing in the primary suitcase was the clothing purchased in Mr. Gauci's shop on December 7, 1988. The purchaser was, on Mr. Gauci's evidence, a Libyan. The trigger for the explosion was an MST-13 timer of a single solder mask variety. A substantial quantity of such timers have been supplied to Libya. We cannot say that it is impossible that the clothing might have been taken from Malta, united somewhere with the timer for some source other than Libya, and introduced into the airline baggage system at Frankfurt or Heathrow when, however, the evidence regarding the clothing purchaser and its timer is taken with the evidence and an unaccompanied bag was taken from KM-180 to PA-103A. The inference that was that the primary suitcase becomes, in our view, irresistible. As we have also said, the absence of an explanation as to how the suitcase was taken into the system at Luqa is a major difficulty for the Crown case, but after taking full account of that difficulty, we remain of the view that the primary suitcase began its journey at Luqa. The clear inference which we draw from this evidence is that the conception, planning, and execution of the plot which led to the planting of the explosives and the device was of Libyan origin. While no doubt organizations such as PFL, PGC, and the PPSF were also engaged in terrorist activities during the same time period, we are satisfied that there was no evidence from which we could infer that they were involved at this particular act of terrorism, and their evidence relating to their activities does not create a reasonable doubt in our minds about the Libyan origin of the crime. On the 29th of May 2002, Libya offered up the U.S. $2.7 billion to settle claims by the families of the 270 killed at the Lockerbie bombing, representing U.S. $10 million per family. The Libyan offer was that 40% of the money would be released when the United Nations sanctions were suspended in 1999, were canceled, another 40% when U.S. trade sanctions were lifted, and the final 20% when the U.S. State Department removed Libya from its list of states sponsoring terrorism. Jim Kurlander of the New York law firm Kurlander & Kurlander, which orchestrated the settlement, said, These are uncharted waters. It is the first time that any of the states designated as sponsors of terrorism have offered compensation to families of terror victims. The U.S. State Department maintained that it was not directly involved. Some families want cash, others say it's blood money, said a State Department official. Compensation for the families of PA-103 victims was among the steps set by the UN for lifting its sanctions against Libya. Other requirements included a formal denunciation of terrorism, which Libya said it had already made, and accepting responsibility for the actions of its officials. On October 15, 2003, Libya's UN ambassador, Ahmed Owen, submitted a letter to the UN Security Council formally accepting responsibility for the actions of its officials in relation to the Lockerbie bombing. The Libyan government then proceeded to pay compensation to each family of $8 million. And as a result, the UN canceled the sanctions that had been suspended 4 years earlier, and U.S. trade sanctions were lifted. A further U.S. $2 million would have gone to each family had the U.S. State Department removed Libya from its list of states regarded as supporting international terrorism. But as this did not happen by the deadline set by Libya, the Libyan Central Bank withdrew the remaining $450 million in April of 2005 from the escrow account in Switzerland, through which the earlier $2.16 billion compensation for the victims' families had been paid. The United States announced resumption of full diplomatic relations with Libya after deciding to remove it from its list of countries that supported terrorism on May 15, 2006. On the 24th of February, 2004, Libyan Prime Minister Shiraki Grandman stated in a BBC Radio 4 interview that his country had paid the compensation as the price for peace and to secure the lifting of sanctions. Asked if Libya did not accept guilt, he said, "I agree with that." He also said there was no evidence to link Libya with the April 1984 shooting of police officers Yvonne Fletcher outside the Libyan embassy in London. Gaddafi later retracted Gunman's comments under pressure from Washington and London. The civil action against Libya continued until February 18th of 2005 on behalf of Pan Am and its insurers, which went bankrupt partly as a result of the attack. The airline was seeking $4.5 billion for the loss of the aircraft and the effect on the airline's business. In the wake of the SCCRC's June 2007 decision, there have been suggestions that if Magari's second appeal had been successful and his conviction had been overturned, Libya could have sought to recover the $2.16 billion compensation paid to the relatives. Interviewed by French newspaper Le Figaro on the 7th of December 2007, someone said that the seven Libyans convicted for the Pan Am Flight 103 and the UTA Flight 772 bombings are innocent. When asked if Libya would therefore seek reimbursement of the compensation paid to the families of the victims, Saif Gaddafi replied, "I don't know." Following discussions in London of May 2008, U.S. and Libyan officials agreed to start negotiations to resolve all outstanding bilateral compensation claims, including those relating to UTA Flight 772, the 1986 Berlin bombing, and the Pan Am Flight 103 bombing. On the 14th of August 2008, a U.S.-Libya compensation deal was signed in Tripoli by U.S. Assistant Secretary of State David Welch and Libya's Foreign Ministry Head of American Affairs, Ahmed El-Fattori. The agreement covers 26 lawsuits filed by American citizens against Libya and three by Libyan citizens in respect to the U.S. bombing of Tripoli and Benghazi in April of 1986, which killed at least 40 people and injured 220. In October of 2008, Libya paid $1.5 billion into a fund which will be used to compensate relatives of the Lockerbie bombing victims with the remaining 20% of the sum agreed to in 2003. The American victims of the 1986 Berlin bombing and American victims of the 1989 UTA Flight 772 bombing and Libyan victims of the 1986 U.S. bombing of Tripoli and Benghazi. As a result, President Bush signed Executive Order 13477 restoring the Libyan government's immunity from terror-related lawsuits and dismissing all the pending compensation cases in the U.S., the White House said. U.S. State Department spokesman Sean McCormick called the move a laudable milestone, clearing the way for a continued and expanding U.S.-Libyan partnership. In an interview shown in the BBC Two's The Conspiracy Files, Lockerbie, on 31st of August 2008, Saif Gaddafi said that Libya had admitted responsibility for the Lockerbie bombing simply to get trade sanctions removed. He went on to describe the families of the Lockerbie victims as very greedy. They were asking for more money and more money and more money. Several of the victims' families refused to accept compensation due to their beliefs that Libya was not responsible. In February of 2011, in an interview with the Swedish newspaper Expressen, Mustafa Abdul Jalil, former Justice Secretary of Libya, claimed to have evidence that Gaddafi personally ordered El-Megari to carry out the bombing. He said he expressly told Gaddafi, he gave the order, Gaddafi gave the order to Abdel Beset El-Megari, the only man convicted in the bombing of Pan Am Flight 103 over Lockerbie, Scotland, which killed all 259 people on board and 11 on the ground and 21 in December of 88. To hide it, he did everything in his power to get El-Megari back from Scotland. Abdel Jalil was quoted as saying, Jalil's commentary to the Expressen came during widespread political unrest and protests in Libya, calling for the removal of Gaddafi from power. The protests were part of a massive wave of unprecedented uprisings across the Arab world. In Tunisia, Morocco, Bahrain, and Egypt, where Egyptian protesters effectively forced the removal of long-term ruler Hosni Mubarak from office. Jalil's comments came on the day when Gaddafi's defense and refusal to leave his command prompted his brutal attacks on Libyan protesters.
So some are saying that Libya took the blame just so that they could pay to have their sanctions lifted.
So they could be a functioning country again in terms of trade and everything of that nature.
That's kind of sick.
Like they looked at it going, well, there's no other way around this because nobody's going to believe us anyway. So the only thing we can do is say we're guilty. And that's what we're going to do. That's what people are claiming.
Okay.
I don't know the answer to that at all, but that's what the
right.
Some are claiming is the reason for it. But, I mean, there's a lot of evidence that points to it being that direction as to where it came from. You know, you'll always have doubt on something when someone says, no, that's not true. I mean, I guess the only time you can sometime get, you know, the true answer is if everybody says it's true, but even then you have them saying, no, it's true, we did it. And then later, no, we didn't do it. So what's the story?
Right.
You know, it leaves you wondering. I think more than anything, if you're a family member, you just want the answer more than anything, you know, more than the money, more than this or that. You just want to know who did this.
Sure.
And justice to be played out against those responsible. And if for some reason it wasn't them, then who was it? Then we got to figure that out. I mean, they just want the damn answer and not somebody just raising their hand going, I'll take the blame so we can keep moving on in class.
Yeah.
And is that the case? I don't purport to know the answer to that, you know, or to know one way or the other. I don't know enough about the case. But I learned much more about the case today on the show than I knew of how this all played out.
Right. Me too.
So very interesting to hear. I think one of the most shocking things to me about this case is just how long the case went on for.
Mm-hmm.
Literally, like, into the last 10 years, there's been elements of this case at play for something that happened in 1988. So, I mean, I think there'll probably always be elements of this case that will remain a mystery or unknown or someone claiming responsibility or not claiming responsibility. But at the end, obviously, 270 people lost their lives and families were changed forever. And the search for just a simple fucking answer, not so simple.
Right.
So that's going to wrap up today's episode of The Dark Side of Wikipedia. Thank you guys for listening. If you like the show, press subscribe, whatever platform it is you are listening to us on. Let your friends know that we exist. We cannot do the show without you. Until next time, for all of us at The Dark Side of Wikipedia, I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for listening.
Moto Casino.
America's Social Casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends. With thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino. America's Social Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Hi, Uncle Laser here. America's built on fast cars, fast food, and even faster women. Moto Casino's built in America. You know what they're fast at? Fast cash prize redemption. You see, only Moto is U.S. owned and operated. Moto, it's American made. That's who we are, and that's who we care about. Play for free at Moto.us.
Moto Casino's the social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details. Must be 21 plus.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on two purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit Dick's.com/scorecardplus for details.
Hi, Uncle Laser here. America's built on fast cars, fast food, and even faster women. Moto Casino's built in America. You know what they're fast at? Fast cash prize redemption. You see, only Moto is U.S. owned and operated. Moto, it's American made. That's who we are, and that's who we care about. Play for free at Moto.us.
Moto Casino's the social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details. Must be 21 plus.
Moto Casino. America's social.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on two purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit Dick's.com/scorecardplus for details.
Here's golf legend John Daly.
Hell yeah, these wins are piling up faster than my divorces.
I only spent on Moto, America's social casino. You know I've won a couple of majors. And on Moto, I've won majors, grands, and epic jackpots on their classic Vegas slots with huge, huge bonus rounds. Moto Casino adds new games and awards players free coins every single day. Grip it and spin it on Moto Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on two purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit Dick's.com/scorecardplus for details.